Cool, but this seems to be working. Hopefully we don't get the quick crash, but we'll be a quick rebound anyway. So if you guys are ready, I am.
Want to see what we got?
Let's do it. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens.
This week on the episode, we have a guest who comes from a recommendation from some DMs in the Grand Gang. And we have been asking for guest recommendations and asking for those things. And to get a good one feels really, really good. So pretty quickly, I reached out to Lisa Allen at Heater Allen, a brewery that I'm certainly familiar with. I haven't been able to have much of the beer, so geographically distant from you guys over there. I believe that Noah has, but we'll get into that. But pretty quickly, you responded. You said you have a very light day on Wednesday that looks like it's turning into a longer day. So we appreciate you squeezing us in. Lisa Allen, head brewer and namesake at Heater Allen.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us.
Yeah, of course.
For anybody who may not be familiar, maybe more on this side of the coast, give a little breakdown of what Heater Allen is as a brewery. I certainly, when I think Heater Allen, I think incredible font and incredible lagers. Why don't you say it in your own words?
It was not incredible font in the early days. We had a moment with papyrus. It was not great. So we specialize in German and Czech style lager beers. Primarily, I would say we lean definitely more German, although our flagship is more of a Czech-style Pilsner. But yeah, it's a family brewery. So my dad started the brewery back in 2007. I joined the brewery in 2009. Allen, as you said, namesake. So Heater is actually my mom's maiden name, and then Allen, my last name, my father's last name. So
incredible maiden name.
If the whole fermentation thing didn't work out, that name could have been, I guess it's not anyone's technical name, but it has athlete, movie star, something written all over it. Class bully, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. But to counter you, Matt, I actually have not had any of the beers, and then just kind of listening up on the brewery, mostly just listening to other interviews you'd done, it shouldn't be too surprising because of your production. I didn't realize it struck me that the brewery is really one of those that has a much bigger reputation than their output, which I think speaks a lot of sort of about the intangibles, which is just kind of what made me really teed up to talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. A brewery that I'm incredibly familiar with, and I've been in beer a lot for a shorter time than Noah has. But before we get into Heater Allen itself, there's a kind of a cool parallel. Well, you're in a family brewery. We are obviously Bissell Brothers.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get into, before you started working, you said there was a 2-year period there where you did not work for your father's brewery. You were in winemaking, if I understand correctly, right?
Yeah. I worked in the wine industry for, about 3-ish or so years before moving to beer. So. Yeah.
And can I ask just one quick thing about that? Because, and I'm sure this is just sort of the bullet points of when you talk about it, but the way you speak of it is that you basically worked like an absolute maniac for like a few weeks, and then there's not really much talk about what happened the rest of the year. So is it really that harvest loaded, I guess I'd say?
I mean, that's kind of there's a little bit more to do than that, but it is very like, I mean, harvest is your busiest time of year, and usually and like when you're bottling, whenever that is, which I feel like a lot of wineries are like, for some reason, they're bottling right before harvest. I mean, it's probably because they need to get tanks and barrels empty. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of the two really busy times. It sometimes feels like that, I'm sure. And especially as someone who primarily the cellar work that I did at wineries was during harvest. So most of my experiences during harvest. And it sure felt like to me that it's just like all this stuff to do. And then all of a sudden it's just like, okay, what do I need to do? Like, yeah. Do we just twiddle our thumbs for a couple weeks? And
Yeah.
That sounds like how September can feel in Maine a lot of the time, of like, you can't even remember when you were born. And then all of a sudden you have time to do anything. And it's just sort of jarring, the kind of break slam.
Yeah. I was going to say, just, it's, there's like, I'm trying to think what I was going to say, for beer, it's just a lot more consistent than winery. I mean, cause like I've had winery friends saying like, oh, you have harvest every week. And I'm like, well, I mean, kind of, but not really. Like, it's not that crazy.
Yeah. If you figured out how to weigh where we could, you know, rotate grapes that way and we could just do a sustained slow harvest all the time, that would be, let me know. And I'll get out of the wine world real quick, but just one kind of last obvious question that I guess I've never been able to ask someone, but how on the whole kind of with over a decade sort of behind you, how translatable do you think those, you know, the cellaring skills you had picked up were to a different medium?
There are a lot of similarities. There's also a lot of differences. So, I mean, you're using the same, I mean, just on a very basic level, you're using the same fittings in a lot of cases, same hose, like types of hoses. You're using a lot of the same chemicals. And so kind of that sort of stuff. You do, I always felt with, I think the wine world has changed a lot since, again, it's been 10 years since I've been in it. And I think they are doing, adding more methods to their cleaning processes. When I was there, they would still do like an acid clean, but they wouldn't like use a caustic or anything like that. It's pretty different other than that. I mean, I'm trying to think of you're using a lot of the same. I mean, there's stuff I'll probably think of stuff later that I'm like, oh yeah, like this.
Wait, I remember. Can be
very translatable to beer. But again, it's been such a long time. I'm like, oh yeah, what did I bring over?
Totally. And I asked that coming from a brewery, like with, I don't know how much Matt told you about, but we have sort of our main production facility in Portland, Maine, where, yeah, probably 95% of our beer comes out of. And then where we're coming to you is where I grew up, about 2.5 hours north, as a mixed firm facility that we opened up. So like, considering that it doesn't seem like you're messing with barrels a whole lot, it seems like that I'm look around me and I literally see wine barrels. So probably when you're doing barrel work, there's a lot of things that are probably, ooh, that was a weird noise. I don't know why I did that.
Yeah. And as you mentioned that, yeah, doing kind of a lot of the barrel work is probably, there's a lot of similarities in that and how you need to treat that and all of that.
Well, thanks for entertaining those questions, because it's not a trajectory you hear about a ton, or a transition anyway.
So you hear about it more almost the other way of transitioning from one to the other.
Yeah, I do feel like I know more people that went from beer to wine than wine to beer. So,
and wine's not much of an option here, really. There's like, so it's probably a pretty different environment in the PNW.
But for Heater Island itself, kind of the traditional homebrew turned pro story for your father, and for me, just kind of begs the question: would imagine that you had to kind of grow up in and around that, and then you kind of find yourself into something that's very close and adjacent to that, but not kind of chasing the exact same thing as your father. Can you talk about how you got into wine in the first place? Was some of that maybe conscious, or was that not conscious? You know what I mean?
There was a decent amount of influence, from my parents. They, I live in McMinnville now, but I grew up in a much closer to, Portland. And so grew up like around craft beer. My parents were very into craft beer, very into wine as well. So, I feel like it was kind of my, sophomore year of college when I wasn't able to drink legally, but my parents knew I was drinking at school. So like they would let me have a glass of wine with dinner and became kind of really interested in the aspect of wine that way. But I've always been interested in beer as well. I mean, yeah, my dad was a home brewer. I want to say he probably since I was like a toddler, I think when it was legal in Oregon, like he started doing it, as well as like both my uncle, his brothers, my uncles. And then, yeah, like just, you know, going to craft breweries all the time and all of that sort of stuff. So, kind of got me interested not only in wine, but like in beer as well. So, I was the annoying like 19-year-old asking my older friends to buy me like a 6-pack of, you know, Deschutes Mirror Pond or something.
I know that 19-year-old very well. Yeah, every time I open the mirror.
Yeah.
So as that transition does happen and you move from wine to, okay, I am going to get involved in the family business and my dad's business, what was kind of the catalyst for that and how did that actually happen?
So it was actually, my dad had to get, I can't remember if it was a hip or knee, but he had to get a hip or knee replacement. So it was kind of like, he asked me if I would come and work at the brewery, kind of hold down the fort for him while he had to get this surgery done. I started working there in at the end of the year in 2009, and I think his surgery wasn't scheduled till spring. So he was like, okay, I have enough time to like teach you how to do stuff. I always thought I would go back to wine. I was still taking wine making classes, actually. Mm-hmm. I really fell in love with the process of beer. I've always, like I was mentioning about the craft beer stuff, I've always loved beer too. So, and it's also when it's something that's in your family as well, there's kind of this little special connection you have.
Totally.
And I really, you know, was, took that family connection. I'm like, I really believe in like what my dad is trying to do and what he's trying to do with Heater Allen. And that's something that, you know, I can get behind. So, yeah.
That's super cool. And I usually when someone has a dad that homebrews, or at least when you hear about it, it's pretty much like in the wackest possible way once a year. With the extract kit, when do you remember him taking it, like, especially reflectively now, like serious?
I think it was when, I remember being, I think it was like in either older elementary or like middle school. So maybe like the 10, 11, 12 age. And, he would like brew in the garage, and I remember just like, I'd be like, wow, that smells terrible. What is he doing? And my, one of my uncles that, my uncle Bob, who actually we have a beer named after,
Bob,
who unfortunately passed away. Yeah. But, he was actually one of the people that got my dad into homebrewing, and he was really into it too. And so they would, you know, like trade recipes and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, I would say that, and so that was probably, it was probably like early 90s, I would say, when he got really into it, doing the, doing like all malt and stuff like that. It's probably earlier than that, honestly. It was probably like as soon as he had a decent sized garage. We moved when I was about 6 in like 1989. And so I think once we had a decent sized garage, he was like, okay, brew space.
Yeah. No time. So. Yeah. That different sort of timeline, like time period, is so interesting and just very, I guess maybe inspiring in a certain way for me, because like I'm pretty aware that really the reason we were able to open the brewery is from the internet, like from the resources that were available to me in like 2010, 2011, which you know, 15, 20 years before that, just there were like two books that got updated like every decade. And they're great books. Don't get me wrong. They're still, I started with How to Brew. But that's just crazy to think, and just really also probably very cool for everyone in your, like the periphery of your family to watch, watch him like with this sort of, oh, nutty professor hobby that people look at, and then slowly but surely it becomes like this respect thing, and at least, just very cool.
You mentioned it being related to family and being excited to be able to believe in what your dad was trying to do. At that time in beer, to kind of put some words to that, what was your dad trying to do when he opened Heater Allen from a beer perspective?
I think, well, so originally he started, it was, definitely like a nano situation. He was on like a one barrel system. And, I think initially he was just trying to see if there was a market for craft lagers. He became obsessed with making like the perfect Pilsner when he was homebrewing, and made like a ton of batches in a row just to like, and he was like, okay, I'm going to like see if this has commercial viability. And he's a business guy. His first first job was in like finance and banking and stuff. So he's kind of like, you know, has to make sure he can make it work financially. After a year in business, he found that there was very much a market for craft lagers. So that's when we moved up to our first kind of more professional system, which was a 7-barrel system. And then now we're on, excuse me, now we're on like a, we're on a 15-barrel, 3-vessel JV Northwest system. So, gone from kind of taking that slow growth journey rather than just right off the bat, you know, being like, okay, 30 barrels. So,
I'm again, just going back to what I had mentioned earlier, it's when I heard that, and I don't know, I guess probably the last things I would have heard were a year or two old at this point, but that it seemed like production annually was hovering around 1500 barrels, and that just really, really shocked me, just again from the influence of the name or notoriety. Totally. Or is notoriety usually a bad word?
I don't think so.
Okay, I don't mean it like that.
It's not.
I think you're thinking of notorious, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe it is, yeah. It's a place, especially people in the industry, like,
100%.
It's the place you drink lager in Oregon, which is, for that production, I was just shocked, honestly, frankly. What are your, either from talking to your dad or just sort of recollections from the outside? I mean, when I think about 2007, you know, you could still make an argument that lager's an uphill battle for many now. It's, I think, a very different type of one. But even that's almost like over a hump in the beer industry, where IPA at least wasn't as totally ubiquitous as it had became over the next 10 years. But what was that like, especially in a market that I don't really understand or know much about at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was pretty tough. I think that's one of the reasons why we're kind of the size we are and not super big. We are that, I should say too, we are around, we were around 1500 barrels. We're around about, we'll probably be about 1200 barrels this year. We haven't really caught up from pandemic situations. Mm-hmm. IPAs are still, you know, super popular in Oregon and always have been. I mean, we're in, you know, hop country, and that's kind of, I feel like when people usually get into craft beer, that's what they get into. A lot of them start with IPAs.
I did. And
nowadays, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I did too. So I think it's still sometimes is a challenge. I think we are seeing a more kind of, educated beer connoisseur now, or even not a connoisseur, but just an educated beer drinker, where people know more about lagers. They know more about, you know, different styles that are out there on the market. So it's definitely changed. And I think it's, there was a while where I kept on being like, okay, is this going to be the year of the lager? I think we finally hit it in like 2018, I want to say 2017, maybe. But yeah, and you know, and I think it's just, people have this idea of what lagers are. And I think that's because of, you know, the big guys. And so I think there has been some like, you know, growing and educating and all of that. But yeah, I mean, I think going back to, that was like a very roundabout way to answer your question.
No, it's great.
but going back to kind of like, I think that, I think from my dad's point of view, like when he started, he was kind of like, no one is doing this. So, you know, there is clearly a market for this. And yeah, and you know, we've been lucky to be here for 15 years and 15 hopefully we're years. Hopefully we're here for at least 15 more.
So. Time flies when you're brewing slow.
Exactly.
That was so good. I lost myself a little bit. You would kind of sort of touched on it a little bit, but Matt and I have talked about it before, but it's just sort of, I've grown to sort of view it as sort of silly, this whether you call it dogma or like a myth or just belief that's held that like, the way you transition people into much more expensive beer than macro is just the same style, but more expensive. I've found that to almost never be the case. I guess to your point about maybe 2018, 2017, maybe being a bit of a getting over the hump, and I'm sure being across the country, we're in slightly different timelines on some trends. But I guess I've seen it a little bit, but it's usually not by someone coming in cold the beer. It might just be that someone that's open to craft beer, one of our lagers becomes their favorite beer of ours, but it's usually not the beer that showed them the way, you know? Did you guys kind of play to that or try to play to that earlier on or even now?
Not really. I mean, I think we knew that going into it, like, we're going to have to go after, like, the more kind of nerdy beer person, especially at first. And yeah, and to your point, like, I would say, too, I mean, we have people that come into the tap room and they maybe, like, have their, like, father-in-law or have their, you know, friend that doesn't really drink craft beer. And so we can usually put, you know, find something that they want to drink and that they enjoy and stuff like that. But, you know, they're probably going to go back to what they usually drink. So it's just kind of, I do think you have to, I mean, and I think that if people, especially, this is maybe kind of tangent-ish, but
let's go.
Bring it on. That's right up our alley.
The point that I think that, I mean, people will drink at, I think that if you have a warm and welcoming spot to locals, especially like if you're in a smaller town, you can, people want to support you. And so they're going to come and drink your beer. It might not be what they drink at home, but they're going to come and hang out with their friends and they're going to drink your beer. And they might not really be into craft beer. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's something that where you do have a ton of, if you do just have like a wall of, you know, IPAs and these super beers that maybe aren't super approachable to someone who usually drinks MGD or something. You know, you can find a middle ground, even though they're maybe not going to drink that all the time. And maybe they will. Maybe they will turn to start drinking your beer.
Well, in the spirit of tangents, I think it'd be interesting for Matt to kind of, so Matt's the general manager in Milo. And what you're describing is a
to a T. what this is. So I'm the beneficiary of what you just said to a T, where we do, the brand has notoriety. People do come and there's some of that, but what the core base of the business needs to be in a place with such seasonality needs to serve the local geography to us. Like,
yeah.
Memorial Day to Labor Day are going to go regardless, but then there's yeah. 9 more months of the year you need to find a functioning business. And I very much see a customer base that believes as much in the story, in the narrative, in the feel good of the space, in the feel good of what supporting it gives them and something to believe in and what they're doing as they are about the beer. But for that large section of kind of my customer base, we have beers, our Pilsner Precept and a couple of these other beers that they have really grown to know and love. And you start to hear the stories of like, well, I can't drink that Miller Genuine Draft anymore. I can't drink some of these different beers. They don't have the flavor that this does. And you start to see them get into that place. What is the... I guess for us, that is very much based around geography. What is the kind of what McMinnville is in general in Oregon? What are you serving for a customer base? What's the geography? What's the size?
We're kind of, I would say we're pretty heavy tourist as well. Mm-hmm. Ours is more, I mean, it is a little bit seasonal, but we're more year round. McMinnville is in kind of the heart of Willamette Valley wine country. So we're kind of like the McMinnville's like the Napa of Napa Valley. when you think of it that way. And so we are, you know, catering to tourists and like, this is, we have wine available and a lot of the tap rooms and tasting rooms here or like beer spots have wine available because you have people that their friends might want to drink beer, but they want to have wine. So yeah. You have that available. There's also quite a few blue collar workers in McMinnville, and actually, kind of a story. There's a rubber company. They take like little rubber bits and make them into mats that are in like playgrounds and that mm-hmm. you can put in your restaurant and stand on and stuff. And we currently don't have a forklift, and so we get the forklift driver from the rubber company to come over and help us out because they're right across the street and, give them a 4-pack of beer because that's what you do when someone helps you out. And the forklift driver over there has told me now, he's like, you've like ruined me on other beer. I'm like, he's like, I have to go to the grocery store. Like I have to go to Ross in town, this like kind of local grocery store, and buy Heater Allen now. So
it's the most wholesome thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. So, but it's cool though too. Cause we now have, there's a bunch of those guys after work that come over. I mean, we have limited hours. We're only open Fridays and Saturdays right mm-hmm. now. And yeah, there's like a whole group that comes over every Friday and has a couple beers and stuff like that. So we're trying to, it's like, it's a mix of people. So you want to have stuff that everyone is going to have. And we're going to expand the tap room next year and we probably will have an IPA on tap. So.
Ooh. But I do, that was my follow-up to kind of teeing all that up is what you just said. Because you certainly have world-renowned beer at the same time. Do you find yourself needing to strike a balance? Or is there a way, I don't want to use placate in a negative sense, but just the way you kind of are, you're trying to reach two very different types of people sometimes. And I find that, frankly, I find kind of like my bandwidth and what I'm thinking about is very much around that a lot of times, how it's two very different types of people I'm trying to reach in the messaging and the
well,
way you do
point,
that and things like that.
A lot more than two.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, just, yeah. Like the whole.
When I say
yeah.
two, I just mean like
I know
there's
yeah,
a
I know.
Massive spread between them.
Just,
but certainly,
it's tricky stuff. You're totally right. Didn't mean to cut you off though.
No,
I just
no,
wanted,
not
didn't
not
want
at
to
all.
Shortchange your job.
Yes. But to that, do you find yourself thinking about that balance and how you deal with that balance?
I mean, I would say more so a few years ago when we were open, we would get people that would come in and be like, oh, you don't have an IPA and just like immediately leave. We don't really get that anymore. I think we'll try to find something for them on tap. And I mean, our pills is actually pretty hoppy, so we can, you know, and for a while we had an Italian pills on tap, so we can kind of, you know, point them in the direction of something that's a little bit more hoppy, hop forward. But I mean, you know, it's, you wonder if like some of those people in those groups and stuff like that would stay longer if they had like an IPA on tap. Mm-hmm. So, maybe instead of just having one beer, they stay and have two beers. And as trying to, everything kind of trends move a little bit slower in McMinnville. It's a smaller town. And I feel like while in Portland, lagers are pretty popular, in McMinnville, I mean, people, I think, are still a little bit behind that. And, so I think having like an IPA on draft, I think will be an eventual thing at Heater Allen.
Does that bum you out?
Not really. It's kind of one of those things. It's like, it kind of is what it is. I mean, I think I'm more like, I would rather have a really like, nice curated, like good stuff on tap, than try to just, you know, have a bunch of stuff available. But, you know, I think it is what it is. Like, I want people to come to the tap room. I want people to stay. So, and if that means having an IPA on tap, then that means having an IPA on tap. And I really enjoy IPAs too. So, yeah.
When you say a nice curated lineup or draft list, do you mean essentially like spread of the boxes you have checked?
Yeah, I mean, like for me, we're still going to we'll always concentrate on lagers. So it's like, still having a few more options available though. Mm-hmm. I feel like we are a brewery that our beers take a long time, and, not as long as the, mixed firm stuff.
Well, but at least those you don't really have to check on that much.
So it would be nice to have stuff that can come out like a little bit, you know, quicker, and have a dark beer on all the time. Cause like luckily we had our Oktoberfest, Bobtoberfest available, because other than that, it's like everything is pale that we have on tap right now. We have no, like, this is like amber. Everything else is pale.
Yeah.
It's funny to think of it that way with lagers as almost being the same, not the same trap, but sort of putting you in the same situation that we kind of were with IPAs for a while. Like there's variations. You obviously, hop combos, of course, strength, you know, maltiness, obviously there's levers to pull, but there's a certain point where you're like, what's another IPA really going to, or hoppy adjacent beer really going to be adding to this and not actually taking away? So it is funny to think about that in reverse. Yeah. I remember that thought crossing my mind briefly at my first time at Bierstadt. We were there and we were there to do a Wild Goose visit, and, one of the, our packaging manager was with us, and his uncle met us there, who was like a sworn Newcastle Brown guy. Like, was that okay? And we kind of ran into that thing, which is like, there's no brown ale. I'm watching this man almost like self-destruct inside, that not only was there not Newcastle, but not even a brown ale. It's just interesting. And I think you'll see nothing but positives from that at the end of the day, especially as the public, you know, especially brewers continue to know you as the lager, you know, the lager brewer in the state. I think that's a great place to be in. But speaking of lagers, I would love to ask you kind of some, you know, I obviously know I'm not unique in this as someone jumping on sort of our trajectory of, we opened in like the last month of 2013. And I actually, just a quick aside, I definitely, I saw on your website, it mentioned that your dad had brewed 14 straight batches of pills as a home brewer. And God damn, did I relate to that, because we only had one beer for the almost the first entirety of our first year. And home brewing in those kind of 2 years from Pete and I kind of handshake agreement, let's do this, to when we opened, it was sometimes multiple batches of substance a week. So, you know, respect. talking about that made me lose my track there. I guess I just jump right into one thing, is wet hops. Have you ever used, being in the region you are, one of my favorite lagers we do, we're hopefully brewing it on Friday, is a wet hop. Yeah. A lager brewed exclusively with wet hops. And, I'm curious if you have experience with that.
We've done one. It was, when was
Sounds
it?
Like it went great
2017?
by your reaction.
A little hesitancy.
it was fine. I think people really liked it. The problem with kind of our timing of things, because we do give everything, you know, like an 8 week time, we did it on the hot side. It took a long time and it tasted fine. It was just like, we used to do this beer called, we haven't made it in a long time. I actually shouldn't say we used to, because we might still make it at some point.
I know the feeling.
Called Coastal. And it's just it's kind of like an IPL, honestly. It's like an amber lager. We did that with Fresh Cascades. And that's the main hop in that beer. And it was good, but it's hard for us because I feel like always with wet hops, you have to be kind of able to shift your schedule a little bit. Yeah. And that can be really hard for us.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say I will never do one again, because I would totally be open to doing one again. We just haven't done one since then. It's that season out here. Everyone is doing them. That's what's going to be on tap for the next month.
Yeah.
So I enjoy them, but it's also fest beer season. So
enjoy more.
Just quickly on that, I think sort of the first, so there's obviously the hop availability is nowhere like it is for, being in Oregon for wet hops, but the farm in Maine has like five varieties, maybe. So we started kind of doing that sort of what you're describing is like, well, I guess we'll be another brewery that will make an IPA with the same Nugget, Cascade, and Centennial as literally the same thing everyone's doing. And then taking the lager route kind of worked two ways, because I was really surprised by how well sort of the uniqueness showed up in a way that it just kind of came across as straight, you know, leafy, kind of light asparagus-y with when we had done the IPA. But the other thing was like, oh, it's a wet hop, not IPA, which I think helped it sort of be interesting to some people. But for what it's worth, and I'm not trying to get hung up on this, but Willamette was when the first two or three years was with Willamette, and it... we have a dog next door. he likes wet hops. I think
for a minute the barking, he's so loud I thought it was him from all the way across the street.
Like,
I was like, that's my dog.
I closed all the blinds. I'm like, come on guys,
you can do what you can do.
But yeah, Willamette was awesome, and then when we had to switch to Cascade, it definitely was not nearly as good to me, so maybe it was a variety. But moving on past that, let's talk about fest beer. First of all, I guess you talked a little bit about, I think, in the beer and brewing episode, but just to start off with maybe your personal opinions on the differentiation, like what a fest beer should be. Should it be basically an amber Marzen, or more like a, like something like that Mars and Sierra collab from a few years back was almost completely pale?
Yeah, so it's a like Fest Beer Wiesen, I think, is the the technical name for that style beer. I think both styles are great. I've made both styles before. Our Oktoberfest beer we do is more of, it is more done in the Märzen style. So it's an amber. But yeah, I love both. It's like my favorite style of beer. I love fest beer season. And I love the pale ones too. So there's, I think that's what a lot more breweries are doing, those like Wiesens, the more pale ones, which are now, that's what you would find in Germany if you went to Oktoberfest, rather than the traditional Märzen, which I think, like, when we started brewing Bobtoberfest at Heater Allen, I mean, you know, it was 15 years ago. And what people know of as Oktoberfest beer has changed. I feel like, you know, in the early 2000s, it was, people expected an amber Oktoberfest. And so that's what we've always done. And I think that's what we'll probably continue to do. And, but yeah, I think they're both really delicious styles of beer. And really fun to drink this time of year. So,
depending on how close to the belt you keep things, totally respect that. But, I've never actually brewed what I would call like a true, like, ruby lager. I think it would be surprisingly tricky to balance, 'cause I've had many more like true Märzen style beers that are good, but they're low on the continuous drinkability factor. And it just seems like a kind of a bit of a tightrope to walk with delivering that much like caramel adjacent malt flavor, even if it's just a huge Munich base, and still creating this beer that is dry in the right ways and all those other things. So yeah, just recipe formulation.
So ours is, it's pretty much like 50% Vienna, 50% Munich 1 is Bobtoberfest, with a little bit of caramel malt, like not very much at all. I think it's probably less than 2%. That is just to get a little bit of the color. I think the trick to getting it so it doesn't finish super sweet is in the mashing process. So at, so we have a heated mash mixer at Heater Allen, and I am like a huge proponent of step mashing for lagers if you're able to. And I think that's how we're able to get, it's just the mashing process. We're able to get it drier. So, and I can't remember the exact mash schedule off the top of my head. But yeah, it's like, and it's, you know, kind of proves for a long day, but yeah, I think that's what really gets that dryness and drinkability. And then I think you also want a decent amount of hop character. I think that people sometimes dial back too much hop character, but you want some in there, because that does help with drinkability and kind of that, you know, that feeling you get on like the back of your tongue when you're, you know, salivating or whatever it is when you want another drink.
Yeah.
I had someplace else I was gonna go with that, and now I completely forgot. Oh, first wort hopping. We have found we do a lot of first wort hopping, and we found that kind of helps with kind of the mouthfeel a lot. And one of the dogs just came into the room. I was like, where did you go?
I was very interested to hear that you were a pretty big proponent of that. We do it on all our beers. It's honestly more of, it developed more from just like, get them in early so you don't miss the addition, if nothing else, especially kind of when I was in your dad's shoes and have to let other people brew my precious beers. No offense, Dad. But yeah, so it's developed that it's a much bigger charge when we're doing a lager, just from how kind of slanted bitterness goes to the earlier in the boil anyway, versus we're definitely one of those brewers that I think you mentioned that is kind of just salt baying like a half pound or a pound of some high alpha hop in for most of our IPAs. So, but how long has that been? Where does your belief in that come from, I should say?
It was kind of experimenting with a few different kind of different hopping regimens. We were kind of tweaking pills a little bit. It must have been when we got the system we're on now, our 15 barrel system, because everything was just like a little bit different. We it's a direct fire boil kettle where our other boil kettle was a boiler, was steam, and much more vigorous. The direct fire is much more vigorous than it was previously. So I think it was kind of trying to tweak things because we were getting a little bit of a different flavor from that. And then also it was something my dad read in the hop book that came out, that like the Brewers Association put out. And it kind of had this weird blurb about first wort hopping where it was just like, people who tried first wort hopping don't know exactly what it is, but first wort hopped beers tend to be enjoyed better than non-first wort hopped beers.
Classic Brewers Association speech.
Yeah, exactly. So we're like, well, let's try this. And then we really liked the way it turned out. So yeah, that became, rather than kind of like a boil start addition. And we don't do it, our first wort, we essentially do it as on, at kettle on. So when we turn the kettle on about halfway through the louder is when we add the first wort hops. So I guess they're not exactly first wort hops.
Well, the first hops you're adding to the wort, that's for sure.
Exactly. There are first wort hops.
That's damn first
hops.
And then just, I want to go back for a second and just talk about the mash mixer, because we... it's almost sort of sounds like the how you develop a lot of processes in a brewery of like, you try it, if nothing else, if it wasn't worse, there's a good chance you'll stick with it out of the hope that it could make you believe that it's much better. So for step mashing, we step mash all our lagers. We don't have a decoction vessel, although for some we'll kind of do a real shitty, like just boil, like use the kettle. And, but it, even that doesn't seem to make a huge difference. But if nothing else, I think for attenuation, I think as you alluded to for the dryness, it seems a lot easier to dial that in. But what's mash mixer life like? Because we're just doing it strictly via infusion.
It's amazing. We used to we used to have a pub system, and so it's like you have boil kettle and then the hot liquor at the louder tun is like on top of the hot liquor tank. I was gonna use like quote hands, and this is a podcast. Our hot liquor tank was really shitty, so we used to actually mash into the boil kettle and hand stir it to utilize a step mash type of situation. And then we would pump it up over into the louder tun. So having a mash mixer was like, I mean, I'm probably a little bit less, like not quite as strong as I was, at least like in my shoulders. Although with everything else I do at the brewery, probably doesn't matter. But, yeah, we would like hand stir in the boil kettle. So yeah, having a mash mixer is fabulous. So.
Yeah, this is not some my life. I have it even harder type thing.
Listen,
I'll
never
do it again. I did it only one time, but we do a corn lager. We kind of have a hush hush, not so hush hush, but love for Bud Light Lime. And we do at 4th of July, we do a corn lager with lime zest that we zest. But one year I the only local corn I could get was just straight up like flaked, like unsteamed. So did a cereal mash in our mash tun, and I straight up don't think my back has ever recovered from like 5 years ago. There's a picture in it, and it literally hurts for me to look at. But
that life sounds painful.
Yeah, it was. But I brought it on myself. How quickly does the question I wanted to ask before I forgot was the direct fire move intentional?
Yeah, it we essentially we would have had to, for our current system, we would have had to replace our boiler, which boilers are very expensive. Mm. And so part of it was because of that. Part of it was my dad being like, Pilsner kettle has a direct fire kettle, so we're going to have a direct fire kettle. So our mash mixer is steam jacketed. So that's what we use our boiler for. And then we have a direct fire kettle.
What other, like, with the boiler for the steam, just because I've only known one brewery myself, really. I didn't work anywhere. Is there a boiler equivalent? There must be something for a direct fire.
It's like a, there's like a weird, so it's at essentially the bottom. You can't really see it. It's in the boil kettle. It's like encased. And if you kind of like, at the back of the boil kettle, there's kind of this little thing that sticks out. Why can I not think of the name of that geometry?
It's killer for audio medium, too. It was an awesome question.
I know exactly.
By me.
How many using my hands does it have? To be.
How many?
Great question.
You can kind of see the flame if you like look underneath, but yeah, it's totally encased. Like you can't even. But we had to get this like very expensive like chimney for it, coming out the back of it. So it has this very nice, very expensive chimney. But yeah, that thing is it. Freaking rips. It's really, really hot. It gets really hot. It's like boilovers were when we first got that thing, it was just like we did it. Yeah, it was bad with boilovers. We had to have someone stand and like spray just the kettle or like turn it off.
Guy.
Just stand up there. Yeah. And then finally learned about firm cap, and so now all is right with the world. Although we still sometimes like have to turn off the kettle for a minute. It's like, it is very intense.
Yeah, we have, I think it was built, I didn't know nearly enough to give anyone any specifics when we got our first system, which was a 10 barrel. But they built it like, it's basically like the dimensions of an oil drum. But like just bigger. It might even be a little more cylindrical than that. And so for the first like learning, it was just there. We had to literally put a hose up there because it was like 15 minutes of just this constantly like desperate searching for that sweet spot equilibrium. That was always so hard, but, so I feel you there.
And back here at this facility, people would ask me, do you ever brew? Do you ever help Noah brew? Or I was like, every now and then I hear some loud yelling back there and I get a hose and I just spray every few minutes. It's that or following with a squeegee, and that's about all I do.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you in terms of kind of looking forward and getting you out on time for your next Zoom meeting on your very, very easy, relaxed Wednesday. Just one of the parallels I've always respected in this brewery, some of our kind of slow growth, especially for the place with which we are in and the beer style that we are in, the type of branding we have. It could have very much been a faster growth cycles. And now I kind of, as we sit now in a different world, that slow growth feels like it might have been the right decision. You guys have certainly taken to the stories you just told and the things you've talked about throughout a very kind of slow approach to growth. In terms of looking out the next 5 years, 10 years, when your dad finally retires and those types of things. But all jokes aside, what do you look at for the future of where you want to take Heater Allen and what you want that growth to look like?
So it's funny you should ask that question because we actually just got we 2 weeks ago got keys to the entire building that we are in. So we're in, it's like a warehouse building. We've had, we've always been in one of the spaces and then we acquired the other space that we've been in probably, I think we got that one in 2013. And then there was a winery next door to us and they actually moved out. So we have, we have empty warehouse space that we are going to fill. So
nothing like on-site space.
Yeah,
I know, and a really cool back area too that we shared with the winery. And so all of their equipment that they use for harvest, they would store back there. And it's now, cause it's like extra tanks and like their press and all sorts of stuff. And so that's all gone now too. So that's why I was saying like, I'm probably going to eventually have an IPA on tap is we're going to make that a really cool beer garden. And kind of, you know, really put a lot of time and effort and money into the tap room. That's one thing I think we've learned is that people want to come to your facility to see it and hang out. And then we're going to kind of move around the cellar and then also add some pieces to it. The brewery is not very well set up. So like when you're saying squeegeeing, like I do a lot of squeegeeing in my day to day. And so, yeah, we're going to move a bunch of stuff around and haven't really figured that out yet because it's still kind of early days, just 2 weeks since we've had the space. But yeah, kind of we are hoping to kind of grow a little bit. We don't want to get too big. We self-distribute in Oregon and we want to be able to continue to do that. And
what's the cap for that out there?
You know, I don't think there is a cap anymore, but I feel like it's not super sustainable once you get over about 3,000 barrels.
Gotcha.
It just becomes like too much. You have to have too many, you know, delivery vehicles, delivery people, salespeople, all of that sort of stuff, that the cost of it doesn't make sense. So I think that's, we'll probably still, you know, who knows what will happen, but we'll probably, I think kind of where I'm seeing it as is we'll probably maybe hopefully get to like 3,000 barrels and kind of stay around there.
Awesome. And hopefully, the sweet spot.
Yeah, sell some more out of the tap room and, you know, get more beer to some of our other markets that haven't been getting as much beer as they want. And
How far do you self-distribute?
We self-distribute. So we actually do use a small distributor for kind of the outliers in Oregon. So like Southern Oregon, Bend, the coast. But the Portland Metro, we self-distribute too. And then we actually right now are currently self-distributing in Seattle. So
that's allowed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Washington's actually, they're not fighting our right to be there, but it's kind of messed up. I think it's kind of messed up because Oregon breweries are allowed to self-distribute in Washington, but Washington breweries aren't allowed to self-distribute in Oregon.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. You at least got to reciprocate.
Yeah. And so there's actually several Washington breweries that have a lawsuit going on to essentially say like, hey, this is not fair. We want to be able to do this in Oregon. So, I'm like, as long as we don't get our rights taken away from self-distributing. Although, I mean, who knows? We may want to use a distributor. Certainly. In Seattle. So,
do anything in any California markets?
We do actually. We don't self-distribute there. We work with a distributor in California. So, California has actually been a decent market for us. I think that is one market. I think we could definitely send them more beer. Right now we haven't been able to send them as much draft beer, I think, as they would like. So, there's the dog again.
Oh, don't worry. No, not at all.
And the dog's not happy about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. I've never heard of, I thought across state lines was just unilaterally banned because I kind of want to join in that lawsuit, bring in New Hampshire into the fray. Yeah. Or Canada, if people are feeling generous, you know?
Hey, let's do it.
Come on.
But self-distribution's strange. It's been super, super important for us, but it's so geography and environment dependent on how much it matters, I think. I think in Maine, with the population there's a lot of state that took us a long time to slowly get to, but Portland, the southern third of the state, has well over like probably 3/4 of the population. So
literally.
So anyway, very excited to see what happens in the next few years for you guys. And just one quick last question. How often do you get called the Moonlight of Oregon? Because it seems like there's a lot of similarities there to me.
Yeah, there kind of are.
They're even, you know, in wine country.
I've actually never heard that.
Okay, before. Yes, yes.
Zero times, not one time.
Zero times. I think we don't get in, or I mean, I have family in California, and I actually lived with my aunt in Berkeley for a summer, and so like death and taxes.
Yeah, runs in the blood.
I drank so much of that beer. So I know Moonlight, but we don't really get that much Moonlight up here in Oregon. So, I will like occasionally have friends that are going down there, bring me like reality check pills and death and taxes and stuff. But yeah, I think we get more, I mean, I think Chuckanut is more well known in Portland. Mm-hmm. Cause they actually have like a little spot in Portland now. So
are they in Bellingham?
Yeah. Technically now they don't have their spot in Bellingham anymore. They're south, just south of that. And I can't remember the name of the town. So
cool. Well, let's
south
not
of
take
Bellingham.
Any south of Bellingham.
South of Bellingham. Heard, yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. We do
absolutely
close up with a little fun to keep it light and easy, that Matt will walk you right through.
Absolutely. I told you at the beginning this would come back to bite you, and I appreciate you being so honest and transparent with me. Read somewhere that you are like a true crime enthusiast. I don't know why I would say it like that, but I happen to be myself. My fiance certainly is. So we do a thing at the end of every episode that we call the Three Bay. We kind of pick a category and give you three things within that category, and then we give you another category where you're going to pick three things. And it's like free association. You put them together and tell us why. So I'm going to give you three true crime podcasts, and you're going to pair them with three Heater Allen beers.
Oh.
And tell us why. Are you up to the challenge?
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, so I will go with kind of the original OG true crime podcast, Serial.
Yeah.
Good. That, I think, might have been the first podcast I ever listened to. We'll go my favorite true crime podcast, which is Crime Junkies, which I believe you haven't heard, but you're certainly familiar with. It's kind of the cream of the true crime pod.
Yes.
From the Earwolf Network.
She's getting after it. And it's got one of the best intros you've ever heard in a podcast. No offense to Jake Hill. Number three, My Favorite Murder. That's one I do know you listen to. It's one that almost everybody listens to. Those are the three: Serial, My Favorite Murder, and Crime Junkies. Pair them with any Heater Allen beer for any reason on planet Earth and tell us why.
Oh, man.
Thought you were going to be out of here in time for your Zoom call, but you might not be.
I feel like from what I've heard about Crime Junkies, even though I haven't listened to it, and because I've had so many friends that have told me I should listen to it, I think I actually am going to pair it with Pills, our flagship.
Wow.
Because, yeah, it's like probably, I think probably a lot of people listen to it. A lot of people really enjoy it. Serial. Oh, man.
That had a great
man,
sound,
this
too.
This is tough. Yeah.
That had great music.
Easy on Jake.
Yeah, that was a good one too. I forgot about Serial. Serial is good. oh man. I think I would have to do that with Dunkel. It's something that like I think a lot of people have listened to and a lot of people enjoyed, but I think also it's kind of like at the back of your mind. Like you're not
Wait, did he do it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Am I actually going to order that style ever?
Yeah, exactly. And My Favorite Murder. What would, I feel like that, I feel like that would probably be the Lisa Lager, which is a seasonal we do. Yep. It's called Lager is Super Awesome because it's like kind of hoppy. It's a hoppy lager in your face and is obviously a little bit fun. Mm. So doesn't take itself too seriously. So yeah.
Who's Lisa?
I think that works.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, I'm just kidding.
I'm
sorry.
I'm so gullible. I was like, wait, what?
Zoom's a pretty easy medium to be tricked.
I was like, it has my name right here, Noah.
Lager is super awesome.
Yes. Lisa Allen, thank you so much for the time. It's great to meet you. Hopefully we see the space someday sooner than later. Please look us up if you're ever on our coast, and we will do the same.
If we are ever on yours.
I definitely need to make it out to Maine sometime
soon. Doesn't sound like you have a ton of time at your disposal in the business operations.
Not right now, but
well,
maybe in like a year.
Yeah, and hopefully we can get out your way, see some family. But thank you so much. Have a great rest of the night, and
absolutely.
Hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm in the mood to be slow.